Thank you, dear listener, for tuning in to Panopticon, a podcast which explores various elements of the occult, culture, and consciousness. And now your host, Andy.
Okay, good evening. Welcome to Panopticon Podcast, Episode 10. Tonight we have Wes Davey from Iraq Veterans Against the War on the line tonight. How are you, Wes?
I'm great. How are you, Andy?
I'm great. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. I served about 3 decades in the military, just under that. Most of it was in the Army National Guard and Army Reserve. I did serve 3 years on active duty, and I retired at the end of 2005. I served in Iraq at the very beginning of the war. We were part of the invasion force in March of 2003. When I came home from the war, and from what I saw there, I disagreed with what was happening there. So for another year and a half, for another year or so, I just kept quiet because I was still in the military. But once I retired from the military, I joined the Iraq Veterans Against the War and started speaking out against the war I disagreed with. I found out about Iraq Veterans Against the War, or IVAW, online. And they have a website. It's ivaw.org. So let me just give you a little bit of the background of Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of people that haven't heard of us. There's a group called the Veterans for Peace, and every year they have a convention. And basically, this is a lot of older veterans from World War II, Korea, and Vietnam who got together and tried to promote peace. In 2004, they invited some of our veterans, the Iraq veterans, to that convention. And at that convention, the Iraq Veterans Against the War was formed. And initially, if I had this right, there was only 7 or 8 people in it to start off with. The only membership requirement is that you have to have served after 9/11. So you don't necessarily have to serve in Iraq or Afghanistan. You just have to serve since 9/11. It's grown to the point now where we have chapters in all states, and we have chapters in foreign countries where veterans are stationed or living. In late 2007 and early 2008, we conducted a vote, and now that was to support the opposition of the war in Afghanistan. To put that a little bit more clearly, we now oppose the war in Afghanistan and have for the last 2 years. So, and we oppose the war for probably the same reasons most people do. I just want to share a few comments from Kevin Tillman. He's the brother of Pat Tillman, and Pat Tillman is the NFL football player who was killed in Afghanistan on April 22nd of 2004. Kevin and Pat joined the Army Rangers together, and you know, they did this after 9/11. They felt they needed to serve their country, and you have to salute them for that. I mean, they patriotically did what they thought was right. They thought they'd be going to serve in Afghanistan and fight the Al-Qaeda there. But what happened is, after their training, they were sent to Iraq, and they both disagreed with the war in Iraq, just as we do, members of IVAW. And I just want to read you a few of the comments from Kevin's article, and it's called After Pat's Birthday, and if you Google that, along with the name Kevin Tillman, it's easy to find. It'll pop right up.
Okay.
So, I just want to read you here. Somehow, we were sent to invade a nation because it was a direct threat to the American people, or to the world, or harbored terrorists, or was involved in the September 11 attacks, or received weapons-grade uranium from Niger, or had mobile weapons lab, or weapons of mass destruction, or had a need to be liberated, or we needed to establish a democracy, or stop an insurgency, or stop a civil war that we created that can't be called a civil war, even though it is, something like that. Somehow, our elected leaders were subverting international law and humanity by setting up secret prisons around the world, secretly kidnapping people, secretly holding them indefinitely, secretly not charging them with anything except secretly torturing them. Somehow that overt policy of torture became the fault of a few bad apples in the military. Somehow back at home, support for the soldiers meant having a 5-year-old kindergartner scribble a picture with crayons and send it overseas, or slapping stickers on a car, or lobbying Congress for an extra pad in the helmet. It's interesting that a soldier on his third or fourth tour should care about a drawing from a five-year-old, or a faded sticker on a car as his friends die around him, or an extra pad in the helmet as if it will protect him when an IED blows his vehicle 50 feet in the air, as his body comes apart and his skin melts to the seat. Somehow, the more soldiers that die, the more legitimate the illegal invasion becomes. Somehow, American leadership, whose only credit is lying to its people and illegally invading a nation, has been allowed to steal the courage, virtue, and honor of its soldiers on the ground. Somehow, those soldiers, those afraid to fight an illegal invasion decades ago, in other words, Vietnam, are allowed to send soldiers to die for an illegal invasion they started. Somehow, faking character, virtue, and strength is tolerated. Somehow, profiling from tragedy and horror is tolerated. Somehow the deaths of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people is tolerated. Somehow the subversion of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution is tolerated. Somehow the suspension of habeas corpus is supposed to keep this country safe. Somehow reason is being discarded for faith, dogma, and nonsense. Somehow American leadership managed to create a more dangerous world. Somehow America has become a country that projects everything that it is not and condemns everything that it is. Somehow the most reasonable, trusted, and respected country in the world has become the most irrational, belligerent, feared, and distrusted country in the world. Somehow being politically informed, diligent, and skeptical has been replaced by apathy through active ignorance. Somehow the same incompetent, narcissistic, virtuous, malicious criminals are still in charge of this country. Somehow this is tolerated. Somehow, nobody is accountable for this. There's an end to that, but I'll read that later on, Andy. So, you know, Kevin pretty much eloquently states there how a lot of Iraq veterans feel and Afghanistan veterans feel. They just feel that what our country is doing is wrong. And because of that, we're speaking out. And back in about 1971, there was an event out in eastern United States. It was called Winter Soldier. What happened there was a group of Vietnam veterans came together and told what they thought were the horrors of the Vietnam War and some of the things that they thought were wrong about that. And in 2008, we replicated that, and we had our own Winter Soldier, and a bunch of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans got together and spoke about what we felt was wrong about the two wars that we were in. And as it happened, there were some of the veterans that were that spoke at the original Winter Soldier came to our event, and they supported us and were there with us. You know, I'd like to speak just a little bit about our group. We're a pretty diverse group, especially when it comes to political diversity, and sometimes that causes internal struggles. I mean, just as the military is diverse, you know, we have Republicans, we have Democrats, we have Green Party, we have Socialists, so it's pretty diverse. And sometimes that causes struggles, but somehow we managed to keep going on. And we have done some good things. We did the Winter Soldier, and then in 2008 we had protests at both a Democratic National Convention in Denver, and they got a lot of worldwide publicity. And then just a month later, the Republican National Convention happened here in St. Paul. And the Iraq Veterans Against the War and the Veterans for Peace marched together in that. And we pretty much led the whole protest march. There's about 10,000 people at that protest march to the RNC, the Republican National Convention. We pretty much led it. And I was fortunate to walk right at the front of that and lead that event. And walking with me were the parents of Lance Corporal Alexander Arredondo. He died in Iraq in 2004 on his second tour of duty. And his parents, you know, they marched in a lot of protest events, and they had Lance Corporal Arredondo's boots with them, and they asked me to carry those at the head of the parade of this protest march, and it was quite an honor to carry his boots protesting the war to the head of the RNC convention here in St. Paul. So those are some of the good things we did, and I've had some interesting experiences, you know, as part of that. When we were marching there, one of the VFP members came running up to me and handed me a cell phone, and so that was pretty interesting. On the other end was Ron Kovic. And if you've read the book Born on the 4th of July or seen the movie with
Tom Cruise.
It was Tom Cruise. I mean, that's who the movie and the book are about, Ron Kovic. And he was calling me just to congratulate or thank me for doing what we were doing, and he asked me to thank all of our members, VFP and IVAW, for protesting the war. So it's been a pretty interesting experience speaking out, and it's something that I feel I have to do. So that's kind of what I like to say about IVAW. Once again, their website is ivaw.org.
Okay, yeah, and I will put a link to that up on the site. You mentioned here in this email wanting to talk about the cost of war in blood and treasure. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, I've kind of relabeled that. I'd like to talk about the cost of war and talk about the first of all the people, because you know, that's the most important thing in this whole mess, this whole friggin' mess. So far, there's been over 6,600 dead coalition forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, when you look at that in comparison to past wars, it doesn't seem like that much. But it would have been double or triple that if it hadn't been for the advances in medicine since even Vietnam.
Yeah.
There's been over 40,000 non-fatal casualties. In other words, the people with TBI or broken bodies that are being taken care of in, say, VA or VA facilities. There's 200,000 to 300,000 troops with post-traumatic stress. That's an estimate from the VA. You know, and then you look at the cost to the Iraqis. We're just talking about the Iraqi war now. But there's our own government figures say that there's 75,000 dead. But there's a British medical journal called The Lancet, and they estimate the dead at over 700,000. Then you add to that the displaced Iraqi citizens, which is 4 to 5 million displaced Iraqis. Right there you're talking virtually the population of Minnesota just leaving the whole state. You know, I'm not a big fan of Saddam Hussein at all, and I thought he needed to be gotten rid of but by their own people. But at least while he was there, the Christian and Jewish populations were allowed to do as they worship as they please. But since the war, because of the Sunni and Shiite struggles between themselves, Christian Jewish populations in Iraq have been virtually decimated, in fact, wiped out. There's just a few left. Many of the rights of the women have been taken away. And there's been fatwas issued by the Islamic clerics against gays and lesbians. Those fatwas allowed gays and lesbians to be killed without any fear of prosecution. So, you know, those are just some of the facts about the people involved. If you want to find out more about the Americans that have died in this war, you can go to the Washington Post website, and they have a thing there where you can look up the soldiers who have died from your state, from your hometown, and you can find out more about them. I'd strongly encourage you to do that. If you go to that website and you click on a name, you look at that person, and you read about them, and you Google that person, you find out more about them, then this war becomes more personal. Right now, these are just numbers I'm shooting on, and it means nothing to most people.
Right.
So if you personalize that by going to finding out more about someone who's died, you're going to take a different view of this whole, of the both wars. You know, and that website has the dead from both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
Okay.
I'll provide that with you so you can post it on your website.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to tell you a little bit about the soldiers that serve, and I want to read an excerpt from the speech I gave about a year and a half ago, because it really tells how I feel about these soldiers that serve, the men and women. First of all, I want to tell you about these people, because most people look at anti-war protesters such as myself, and they think they were just a bunch of nuts, and maybe we are because we're trying to fight the system. And I kind of thought that way beforehand, but I've met so many good people in this anti-war effort who are just trying to stop this insanity. So they think we're nuts, but I want to tell you a little bit about the soldiers I led. Maybe people will have a different opinion about me and about other people who speak out. You know, we speak out for a reason. So here's an excerpt from that speech. The soldiers who I was privileged to know all had one thing in common. They were proud to serve a country and wore the uniform of an American soldier. My soldiers were male and female, white and black, Native American, Asian and Hispanic. native-born and immigrant, straight and gay, Jewish and Catholic, Presbyterian and Baptist. And as General Colin Powell so eloquently told the nation, some soldiers are Muslim. For the most part, we all respected one another, worked hard, and got along very well together. One of my soldiers came to America as a teenage Jewish refugee from the Ukraine. Even though he wasn't yet a citizen, he joined the Army Reserve of his new country just a few days after 9/11. He was slotted into my section as a Private E1, the lowest rank in the Army. He's the kind of soldier every NCO hopes for, hardworking, intelligent, physically strong, and a good sense of humor. Shortly after I returned from serving in Iraq, I watched him take the oath of an American citizen. In May of this year, I had the honor of rendering him his first salute as he was sworn in as one of the Army's newest second lieutenants. What I'm trying to say is that those who serve in the military are, overall, extremely good people and good citizens, and they deserve our respect and admiration. They also deserve this. When we ask them to go to war, to risk being killed and to kill other human beings, we better be sure that what we are doing is right. That didn't happen with Iraq. Too many politicians blindly accepted everything the Bush administration said, and we rushed into Iraq like fools. That's the end of that excerpt. My opinion of those who serve, as I just read, doesn't necessarily extend to the generals and the admirals walking the halls of the Pentagon. So I just want to talk, that's the people part of it. You know, they're really good people, and they deserve our respect and admiration, and they deserve our support, and that doesn't mean a bumper sticker.
Yeah.
So now I'd like to talk about the money that's being used for these two wars. The war cost to date for Iraq is $730 billion, and Afghanistan, $280 billion. Together, that's over $1 trillion, and the cost to each American so far is over $3,000. The long-term cost projected by the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, is over $3 trillion. That's about $9,700 per person per American. You know, that money has to be repaid, and it's money that won't be spent in our communities and state. And I wanted to give you an example of that. I live in St. Paul, and the population here is 277,000. If we just use the amount of money that we've spent so far, that's over $908 million that are going out of the city of St. Paul that won't be spent in our community, that won't be spent at businesses and so forth. Long term, it's $2.8 billion that's leaving our community to be buried in the sands over in Iraq and Afghanistan. I want to give you another brief example, and for people that come from smaller towns, this will really hit home. My sister-in-law comes from a small town in west central Minnesota, and the population is 280 people, 280. So they have about four or five businesses in that town. Just so far, the cost of the money leaving town because of this war is over $900,000. If you told those four or five businessmen that $900,000 is leaving town and never is going to be spent there, I think they'd go ballistic. You know, the long-term cost of that town, that small town of just 280 people is $2.7 million. That's a hell of a lot of money for just a small town.
Yeah.
All of this money has been borrowed to us from China and Saudi Arabia and a few other places. And I just have to ask you, Andy, you know, has this spending got us or brought us any closer to peace? And I think the answer to that is absolutely not. You know, I want to just suggest something else. Instead of pissing away $700 billion a year on the Department of Defense, you know, what if we spend just a small portion of that on a Department of Peace like Dennis Kucinich has tried to do?
Yeah.
What if instead of blowing up a mud hut on an Afghan hillside with a $65,000 Hellfire missile, what if we instead used that money to buy $10 mosquito nets that would protect 6,500 African families from malaria? You know, which is going to produce more allies, blowing up a mud hut with a $65,000 missile or buying mosquito nets for those 6,500 African families?
Yeah. You
know, to me, it's a no-brainer, but apparently not to members of Congress and certainly not to the leadership in the Pentagon.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's some of the people costs and some of the money costs. But aside from that, I want to focus kind of more on Afghanistan, which IVAW is really focusing now. And I just want to talk about why we can't win in Afghanistan. My youngest son is an Army reservist, and he and I were discussing the recent Rolling Stone article about General Stanley McChrystal and his staff.
Right.
Known to the world now as Team America.
Yeah.
And a comment by one of them was of special concern to both of us. And I'll read a quote here from that article. "Even those who support McChrystal and his strategy of counterinsurgency know that whatever the general manages to accomplish in Afghanistan, it's going to look more like Vietnam than Desert Storm. It's not going to look like a win, smell like a win, or taste like a win," said Major General Bill Mayville, who serves as Chief of Operations for McChrystal. "This is going to end in an argument." That's the end of quote. You know, that's not exactly a confidence-building endorsement of the general's plan by his staff. My youngest son will be in Afghanistan in just a few months with his reserve unit. Wondered to me, you know, why are we going to Afghanistan if General McChrystal's own staff has so little confidence in the war's outcome?
Right.
I didn't answer him, but my view of the war's outcome is even more cynical than that of Team America. The Pentagon brass knows that the war in Afghanistan can't be won. They know that. And even though they know we can't win, they have a vested interest in keeping the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq going as long as possible. Both wars have become nothing more than perpetual promotion machines for the officer corps, machines which they have no inclination to shut down. It keeps the officers going up the promotion ladder. That's all these wars are doing. And I'm fairly sure that most of these gold-braided sycophants wouldn't mind a bit if the war in Afghanistan lasted another 5, 10, or 15 years, and that's exactly what they project. You know, and when they retire, they're going to be assured of lucrative jobs in the defense industry.
Right.
Unlike the lower-ranking NCOs when they retire, I can guarantee you that I'm not in the defense industry right now.
Right.
You know, there are many former military people who feel the same as I do about the Pentagon generals and admirals. They just keep promoting his wars because he keeps promoting them. So, the first reason why I think we can't win in Afghanistan is the complexity of the whole war. As an example, I started reading a 400-page book about the history of Afghanistan and Pakistan and how the two countries' histories and politics intertwine. Their history is so complicated that it took me 15 to 20 minutes to comprehend each page I read. You know, maybe I'm not the brightest bulb in the pack, but it was difficult reading.
Right.
Later, I talked to my oldest son and told him that it would take a PhD in Afghan studies to even begin to understand what we've gotten ourselves into over there. My son laughed at my comment, but he also agreed with it. That son that I talked to has been over there twice. So I don't think it's feasible that our military can succeed without knowing that history. In Afghanistan and in Pakistan, you know, friends and alliances made one year might be fools the next year.
Yeah.
And a few of the generals might have a good understanding of their history, but their knowledge doesn't help the lower-ranking troops who interact daily with the Afghanis and wonder why outreach programs aren't working. But even when you have sharp company-grade officers and NCOs who, after a time, have learned some of the history and have a basic concept of knowing why Afghanis do what they do, you run into bigger problems we have, a problem faced by our country since Korea, which is probably unfixable. So the second reason why I think we can't win is this, and it's called the one-year tour of duty. U.S. service members served for the duration during World War II. After World War II, they did studies on combat fatigue, and those studies showed that combat soldiers were burned out after 180 days in a hostile environment. During the Korean War, Congress allowed draftees to serve only 24 months of active duty versus World War II's duration of the war. So you get that 24 months, and if you subtract out the training, the leave, the transit time, after the draftee's 2 years on active duty was used up. This meant that a drafted service member could only serve 1 year in a combat zone. That personnel policy carried on through Vietnam, and it's now been extended to all those who serve, not just draftees. It remains in place, but it has an obvious problem, and that is that the one-year tour of duty deprives units of experienced leadership that will lead until the job is done. As one observer noted, we were not in Vietnam for 10 years, but for 1 year, 10 times. The same can be said for Iraq and Afghanistan. Huh. You know, if you look at that end, Andy, we go there for and serve our one-year tour of duty, and then we come home. And when we come home, we take all that we've learned, we bring that home with us. You know, we may go back and serve another tour, but that the additional tour, the second or third or fourth tour, might be in a different area. And your combat skills might carry over, but the knowledge of the people and the history of that area that you're going to doesn't carry over.
Right.
If you look at a map of Afghanistan, you know it's made up of a bunch of different areas that have different cultures, different languages, and different histories, and you can't even begin to relate one to the other. So you, essentially, when you go to a different place, you're building up or you're relearning everything about that place. So the knowledge that you had from a different area, it just doesn't carry over to a different place. So, you know, that's a problem that I don't think can be fixed. The way to fix it is, of course, not to have a one-year tour of duty, keep us there until the war is over. But I don't think the politicians are going to allow that, nor does the Pentagon want it. I mean, if you just keep doing the one-year tour of duties, these wars will go on forever. You know,
right.
It's pretty evident is what we've seen over the past 9 years in Afghanistan and the past 7 years in Iraq. So that's another reason why I don't think we can win. The third reason why I absolutely don't think we can win, and that's what I think of as the degeneration of the officer corps. You know, my cynicism about a successful outcome in Afghanistan goes more to a significant issue, which is that the officer corps has, in the words of one Gold Star father, they've lost all credibility. I just want to read you the West Point code here, the honor code.
Yeah.
That's this. A cadet will not lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do. You know, after they leave the military academy, officers are expected to know what is right, you know, have the moral courage to act on that knowledge. And in doing so, they will further strengthen their personal commitment to the principles of truthfulness, fairness, and respect for others. That last part I read you, that's a quote from an unknown source that I just don't have the quote for or the source right now.
Okay.
You know, when our sons and daughters enlist in the military, they, and we their parents and spouses, we have an expectation that the officer corps will faithfully follow that honor code. You know, perhaps I was naive when I served and just didn't have my eyes open, but during most of my career in the Army, it was my experience that officers invariably followed that honor code, you know, no matter whether they were West Point graduates or commissions or ROTs or OCS. But many of the events over the past 7 or 8 years have caused me to believe that too many members of the upper echelons, in other words, the Pentagon-type people of our military leadership, willingly set aside that honor code. If doing so, it keeps them moving up the promotional ladder. Now, that's a pretty blunt statement I'm making right there. You know, the disregarding the honor code just to get promoted. But I'll give you some examples of that.
Yeah.
We were only a few days into the Iraq war when PFC Jessica Lynch and other members of her unit were captured by the Iraqi army. I was not too far away when that happened.
Okay.
It didn't take long for them to be rescued, and it didn't take long for the media and the army to turn her capture into something heroic, but something also untruthful. And they made a hero out of her, all done to rouse the patriotic spirit of America and get citizens solidly behind this war. Now, their lies and propaganda worked, at least until PFC Lynch returned home to the United States and exposed the truth. And later on, she testified before Congress that the military was completely untruthful about her rescue. And they did this just to promote the war and to promote themselves.
That was a big PR stunt.
Exactly. Here's another example. The scandal at Abu Ghraib prison just a few months later was another example of the honor code being totally crapped on. When the disgusting pictures of Abu Ghraib abuse were shared with the world, you know, on the internet, I really lost pride in being a soldier and wearing the uniform. This scandal started high up in the chain of command. I assume everyone knows what that means.
Yeah.
The officer corps went into a cover-up mode, and with the exception of one-star reserve general, the only people to face discipline were low-ranking enlisted soldiers. General McChrystal had his finger in that pie, but it came out clean. So I'll ask you, Andy, what part of the honor code prevailed at Abu Ghraib? It totally was crapped on there.
Yeah.
In 2004, came the fratricide in Afghanistan of former NFL football player turned Army Ranger Pat Tillman. You know, that was given a lot of publicity. When he enlisted, he and his brother Kevin, that was given great publicity. So now when he died, they had to do something about that, and they basically covered it up. In 2005, there was a journalist, his name was Radley Balko, and he was with Fox News at the time. He wrote this about the kind of person Tillman was. Quote, Tillman cast an enormous shadow. Far from footballing, soldiering, Bruitt, he was a curious and independent thinker, a man who embraced the challenges of leadership, but shied away from fame and praise. And he was, of course, a guy who, if you pardon the cliche, risked and paid the ultimate sacrifice for his country. His country probably didn't deserve him. At every turn, the U.S. military has exploited, desecrated, and ultimately turned its back on Tillman's heroism. The Pentagon has since closed its doors to the Tillman's family, sharing information about his death only when compelled to do so by members of the media or by the Tillman's family's newfound allies in Congress. End of quote. You know, from Captain up to General McChrystal, Pat Tillman's chain of command was involved in a cover-up that violated every part of the honor code. This incident demonstrates that these officers care more about their careers than the soldiers that they lead, and certainly more than they care about the honor code. You know, if you're a father and you have a son or daughter going in the military, would you want them to serve under these officers?
No.
You know, with my son going over to Afghanistan in just a few months, my answer is absolutely not. I just don't trust the officer quote anymore. Notwithstanding his involvement in the Tillman cover-up, General McChrystal soon gained his third star. So, you know, they took care of their own, the Pentagon brass, and they promoted him. You know, all too often the generals don't try to cover up their screw-ups. They just simply ignore them. And I want to quote from a Washington Post article here.
Yeah.
And this is something that happened recently over the past year or so. Quote, the Army has overruled a military investigator who found that the command failures on the part of three Army officers contributed to one of the deadliest ambushes of the Afghan War. The ruling drew a swift rebuke from a U.S. senator and from relatives of nine soldiers slain in the attack. The soldiers were killed in the village of Wanat when more than 200 Taliban fighters attacked their fledgling base. The initial inquiry by Marine Lieutenant General Richard Natansky concluded that the brigade, battalion, and company commanders had overextended their forces and did not provide enough support for the troops to defend themselves in the terrain. General Petraeus approved Natansky's finding, but General Charles Campbell, whose command was formally charged with sending out letters of reprimand, decided not to take action against these officers. Right now, as far as I'm concerned, the Army's credibility is non-existent, said retired Army Colonel David Brostrom, whose son Jonathan was killed at Wanat. End of quote. You know, the spirit of the honor code is knowing what is right and having the moral courage to act on that knowledge. You know, lacking the moral courage to do what is right, in this case, failing to discipline those officers who screwed up, you know, that violates both the honor code and the trust the family members need to have in the military leaders.
Yeah.
So those are some examples why I no longer trust the officer corps to be honest and to do his right. You know, and as a father, I deeply love my son that's going to Afghanistan. And as a retired first sergeant, it's not comforting at all knowing that our sons and daughters are going off to war, you know, are going to be entrusted to the current officer corps. You know, I just don't trust them, nor do many other people.
Right.
There's a fourth reason why I don't think we can win in Afghanistan. During World War II, citizens joined together for scrap metal drives, and they grew what was called victory gardens. They bought war bonds, and they were subject to rationing. When it came to the military service, the children of the rich and famous served side by side with those of lesser means, like my father's and my uncle's. As an example of that, one of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's sons died shortly after D-Day, and he was leading the rush. He was not hiding in, you know, some comfortable place here in the United States. He was there leading the soldiers. Uh-huh. He died doing it. Even Queen Elizabeth, during the war, she joined up and served in the army. Here she is. She was a princess at the time, but she joined up and served in the army. It was doing something like serving as a mechanic, but she was there doing something. You just don't see that anymore.
Right.
There's a columnist whose name is Mark Shields, and he wrote this, quote, "We have asked everything of the brave few, the men and the women who serve and who sacrifice, and their loved ones. From the rest of us, nothing has been asked other than for the wealthy to patriotically accept more tax cuts. In a morally balanced and just community, there must be a sharing of the risk and the burden of the pain and the suffering." End of quote. There is no sharing of sacrifice in these two wars. And I want to read another quote from Bob Herbert. He's a columnist in the New York Times, and he's probably my favorite columnist. He's been on the anti-war side of this whole thing ever since this started shortly after the invasion in Iraq.
Okay.
He wrote this, "We just funneled the stressed and underpaid troops in and out of combat zones, while all the while showering taxpayer billions on the contractors and giant corporations that view the horrors of war as heaven-sent bonanzas." In another column, he wrote, "If we had a draft, or merely the threat of a draft, we would not be in Iraq or Afghanistan, but we don't have a draft. So it's safe for most of the nation to be mindless about waging wars. Other people's children are going to slaughter." Well, if this is war, now approaching its ninth year, is so fundamental, we should all be pitching in. We shouldn't be leaving the entire monumental burden to a tiny portion of the population, sending them into combat again and again and again. End of quote. So there you have it, and something that I firmly agree with. The combination of no draft and the lack of any sacrifice by Americans has led to a complete apathy about these wars. The wars don't affect people, so they don't care. And that's another example of that is the wars aren't even in the top 10 issues being discussed in this election year. A few years ago, I joined with several other peace groups, and we put together a peace event or an anti-war event at the University of Minnesota. Back during Vietnam, when students' butts were actually on the line because of the draft, there would have been tens of thousands of students showing up to protest the war.
Yeah.
In 2008, with no draft, we had just 10 students show up out of 50,000 students' population.
Jesus.
They just don't care because they aren't affected. So.
Right.
So that's just an example of our whole country is apathetic. And until we get people involved in wanting to win something, we're not going to win this war or any war in the future.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Do you think that there's any kind of... I feel like when Obama was campaigning for presidency a couple of years ago, a lot of people were hopeful that he would really scale back our presence in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Middle East, and that there'd be a big shift away from the Bush administration policies. Have you seen that at all, or can you speak to the differences between Bush and Obama's policies, if there is any?
Well, I had a different take on that. I know that Obama opposed the war in Iraq, and he said he'd get us out of there as quickly as possible, and he's following the timeline that was established back during the Bush administration as far as getting troops out.
Yeah.
But he said he always supported the war in Afghanistan, and so he's just, you know, he's basically following on his campaign promise there. He not only wants to win that war, but he's putting more and more people in there. So as far as Afghanistan, at least he's paying attention to that war. Bush basically, you know, invaded the country and then didn't pay any attention to it for the next 7 years. Well, Obama is at least paying attention to it, but he's listening to the wrong people. He's listening to the Pentagon generals, and I think he is getting us deeper and deeper. And, you know, if you look back just 45 years or so, the same thing happened in Vietnam. We started off small and then just kept adding more and more people until, first thing you know, we had more than 500,000 soldiers over there, you know. First of all, we'll never be able to get that many soldiers to go over there because without the draft, we won't get them. we can't get that many people to enlist. But,
right.
So basically, I think he's just been steered in the wrong direction by the wrong people, and unfortunately those wrong people are, you know, the Pentagon brass and the other part of the security advisors that he has on his staff. So, you know, maybe if he listened to the veterans that were actually over there, he'd have a different view. But I actually supported Obama during the election, but since then, I still think he's done a lot of good things, but one thing he hasn't done good is that he's escalated this war in Afghanistan, and it's not going to come to a good outcome no matter how many people he puts in there or how many new generals he puts over there. It's just not going to come to a good outcome. So,
well, as a veteran who was involved in the invasion and spent a good deal of time in Iraq, what do you think the outcome of this thing will be like? What can we do? What is the American military going to have to do to cease our presence there and the hostilities? And, I mean, how can we end this thing?
Well, first of all, I don't think the military wants to cease its presence. I absolutely think the Pentagon wants to keep this war going on as long as possible. I mean, that sounds very cynical, but they haven't done anything to show me otherwise. I mean, they just keep going on and on. It's a promotion machine. It ensures that they, you know, when they leave the Pentagon, that they get their defense industry job. I just don't see that they have any incentive at all to get us out of there. I don't think they want to get us out of there. They talk about achieving victory, and that sounds nice, but, you know,
I don't even know what that means. Like, what, I don't know what victory is.
That's another thing, you know, they talk about winning in Afghanistan or in Iraq, you know, what does that mean? It certainly won't have any resemblance to what we did in World War II.
Right.
The best we can hope for is the government over there that is somewhat sympathetic or somewhat of a friend to the United States, but I don't even think that's going to happen. So that's another thing that is a pet peeve of mine for a long time. Nobody's ever explained what victory is going to be either in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Right.
And even now, when things have kind of settled down in Iraq, the government there is still something that we can't relate to. It's not really a democracy like we have here. I mean, it may or may not even be sympathetic to us. I mean, when the leader of Iran came to that country and visited leaders there, he was given the red carpet treatment. So, you know, here they are being a friend to Iran, you know. What's it going to look like in the future as far as the United States and Iraq? I just don't see any good outcome from that either. I mean, look what's happening to the people. I mean, whether it's all the people that have been killed or displaced, I mean, I just don't see that ever being corrected. So I don't see any good outcome there, and I certainly don't see any outcome that can be good in Afghanistan.
Okay.
And I've talked to my congresswoman about this, and she thinks we need to be there, but she's never given me a reason why we need to be there for our national security. You know, as far as I know, the Afghanistan Air Force couldn't reach the shores of the United States. As far as I know, they don't even have a navy, so how are they going to affect us? I mean, they can send their Al-Qaeda. They can harbor Al-Qaeda, but if we're diligent about protecting our borders, then they're not going to get in. So, you know, you spend a heck of a lot less on protecting our borders from people like that coming in, the Al-Qaeda or whatever. It's going to be a heck of a lot cheaper than trying to stabilize Afghanistan over the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Right. Well, can you talk a little bit about what Iraq Veterans Against the War is doing now and kind of where they're headed in the future, and maybe a little bit more after that about if there's any, you know, politicians that we should look out for that are actually, you know, intent on improving the situation at all?
The Iraq Veterans Against the War is going to have our annual convention this coming weekend. It's going to be down in Austin, Texas. So we're going to decide where we want to go from there. But I'll be honest with you, our group, just like a lot of other peace groups, we're kind of worn out from protesting wars for the last 6 years. And there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. And a lot of people, including myself, to be honest with you, Andy, are getting burned out. You know, how long can we keep protesting? How long can we keep speaking out? I think we need to do it, but we keep recruiting more people into IVW, but people are leaving too, so it's kind of a standstill right now. And what we're doing right now to kind of improve that, and we have been doing it over the last 6 months or so, is we've got a field organizing teams. There's three of them, and they go out and they're trying to organize people to work towards peace. They've worked with a lot of other groups, such as union workers.
Okay.
And other peace groups, just trying to get people to work towards peace. And they've had some success about that. But it's an uphill battle. I mean, we're fighting the military industrial people. I mean, they just want to keep this going. They've got tons of money. And you look at our fundraising, we have a tough time raising any money to protest. And so, you know, they've got the upper hand in this. We keep working, but it's a burnout thing here. And I'm telling you, even the Veterans for Peace, I talked with one of their national leaders just a few days ago. They're struggling. And they've been at this for 30 or 40 years, and even they are struggling now after protesting, you know, basically since 9/11. So we're struggling to keep on going, but we will keep on going. We're going to work to further the cause of peace. As far as getting any politicians involved, well, good luck on that. There's a few strong people like Dennis Kucinich. And here in Minnesota, we have a couple strong representatives, Keith Ellison and Betty McCollum. They're both strong for peace, and they want to establish a Department of Peace. But to be honest with you, there's not a heck of a lot of people in Congress that want that.
Right.
You know, certainly the Republicans in Congress, they want to continue war. You know, they don't want to pay for it, and they don't want their children serving in it, but they want the wars to continue on. And I'm not sure why that is. I want to give you an example of a Republican acquaintance of mine. He's a typical fat cat Republican.
Yeah.
And he and his wife were flag-waving, gung-ho supporters of abortion and the wars. And when I came back from Iraq, I stopped and visited them. But it was like banging your head against the wall. They didn't understand anything. They have 7 children, but none of their children have served. And here's how bad it is. My son, the youngest son I talked about before that's going to Afghanistan,
yeah,
he's a friend of one of their sons. And when he told this fat cat Republican that he enlisted in the Army, his response was, "What did you go and do a dumb thing like that for?" You know, so... Jesus. The Democrats aren't any better. Most of them were afraid to vote no on the war for fear of being labeled weak on defense.
Right.
You know, and they're as gutless as the Republicans.
Right.
You know, there's some exceptions, like I mentioned, Keith and Betty McCollum here in Minnesota and Dennis Kucinich. I don't think a heck of a lot's going to change, but something has to change. There's a part of that article by Kevin Tillman that I didn't read, and it's at the very end.
Yeah.
But I want to read it now because it's appropriate.
Yeah.
And here it is. In a democracy, the policy of the leaders is the policy of the people. So don't be shocked when our grandkids bury much of this generation as traitors to the nation, to the world, and to humanity. Most likely, they will come to know that somehow it was nurtured by fear, insecurity, indifference, and leaving their country vulnerable to unchecked, unchallenged parasites. Luckily, this country is still a democracy. People still have a voice. People still can take action. It can start after Pat's birthday. End of quote. Pat's birthday was just a month or so prior to the election in 2006 when Kevin Tillman wrote this. So are the politicians going to do anything about these wars? Not if they don't have to. And the only way they're going to have to do something is if we all speak out and demand something. But you know, I've talked about the apathy that's involved in these two wars. I just don't have much hope that the politicians will have any desire or have any motivation to do something, to change everything that I've talked about here, whether it's ending these wars or changing how the Pentagon does business or how we go to war. Unless we speak up, you know, I don't see anything changing. You know, I've spoken out since I retired at the end of 2005, and I don't regret speaking out a bit. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't have any or very many friends left in the military, at least my peers, the upper-ranking senior NCOs. The lower-ranking ones, they'll support me, but still, I don't regret speaking out, even though I've lost a lot of friends. It's something I felt I had to do, you know, for my country, just as Kevin Tillman said here, and for my grandkids and for myself. And so I'll keep speaking up, and it's... Maybe sometimes, at some point, you know, the politicians will listen, but it's going to take a lot more people than the IVW and the Veterans for Peace and the Women's Against Military Madness and all the other peace groups out there. It's going to take more than them speaking out. It's going to take the everyday person to start speaking out, demanding something different. You hear about all these tax protesters, the Tea Party people. They protested spending money on health care and so forth.
Right.
So maybe we spent $100 billion on health care. Well, that is a heck of a lot of money. You know, I'll grant that. But they don't say a word about the $700 billion a year we spend on the Department of Defense and for going to war. They don't say one word. That's all okay. But trying to help people, you know, and they rise up and protest. So, you know, some people get excited about the minor things, but when it comes to demanding peace and being a peaceful country, they don't say squat. So.
Yeah, that's one of the most strange and immoral things about this thing is I think today I was reading different news sites and there were two headlines that were ironically on the same side, and one of them was that some part of Congress voted to quit extending benefits to the unemployed, and then also I think they threw another $30 billion at Afghanistan, and it's just like nobody raises their voice to speak out against all the money we're spending on the military. But if we want to give people health care or like try to make sure that single moms aren't homeless, that somehow goes against the American ideal. I just don't get it.
Well, you've kind of hit the nail on the head there, Andy. I mean, we've got our service members spread out all over the world. I mean, 65 years after World War II ended, we still have 60,000 people stationed in Germany. We have 10,000 people still stationed in both Italy and England. I mean, why are those people there 65 years after the war, World War II has ended? You know, some 50 years after the war in Korea's ended, we still have 30,000 people stationed there.
Right.
We still have 30,000 people stationed in Okinawa and other parts of Japan.
Right.
You know, we're spending all this money making the rest of the world safe, or so we say. But we gripe and moan if we spend, you know, a little bit of money helping people here in the United States that need help. Or we even gripe and complain, you know, if we help some poor families in Africa who just need a mosquito tent to prevent the spread of malaria. I mean, somehow our values need to be changed, and I just don't know how to change those values other than to keep speaking up about the waste in these two wars and the waste in the permanent defense spending. But I'll just keep speaking out. And I hate to lay one more quote on you, Andy, but...
No, please do. Please do.
This is from a columnist. His name is Mike Roykow, and he wrote for a Chicago newspaper. And this was printed back on January 24th, 1973.
Okay.
And it's called The Hollow Ring of Peace. And I'm not sure if it's available online, but I found it in a book one time. And here it is. And it was at the end of when President Nixon announced the end of the war in Vietnam, or at least our participation in it. And here it is, quote, "If we insist on looking something for a value in this war, then maybe it is this. Maybe we finally have the painful knowledge that we can never again believe everything our leaders tell us. For years, they told us one thing, well, they did another. They said we were winning, well, we were losing. They said we were getting out, well, we were getting in. They said the end of the war was near when it was far. Maybe the next time somebody says that our young men must fight and die somewhere, we will not take their word that it is a worthy cause. Maybe we will ask them to spell it out to us, nice and slow, nice and clear. And maybe the people in power will have learned that the people of this country are no longer willing to go marching off without having their questions answered first." End of quote. Well, I can tell you right there, Andy, that our country hasn't learned a damn thing since Vietnam. Or did we learn anything from our experience in Vietnam?
Yeah.
You know, when you go back just 4 or 5 years ago, you saw Dick Cheney on television and then print media all the time saying we were winning, even though we were losing. You know, they said we were getting out, but we kept getting in, and it keeps happening, and we haven't learned anything, Andy. So there's a need for people to keep speaking out for peace, you know. There's a need for people to keep speaking out against the insanity of these two wars. And to the extent that the Iraq Veterans Against the War can, we will keep speaking out. And the same goes for Veterans for Peace. They'll keep speaking out. But we can't do it alone. I mean, people around the country have to realize that something is totally wrong with what we're doing. militarily, and they have to speak out. And they have to speak out against the militarism that our country has, you know, has so embraced. I mean, people have to start speaking out. And until we do that, nothing's going to change. And to be honest with you, I just don't see that happening. Having said that, you know, for the sake of my children, for the sake of my grandchildren, I'm going to keep speaking out. And I'll keep speaking out.
Well, thank you so much for all the work that you've done and are doing and will continue to do, because it's invaluable. And at the least, future generations will continue to thank you for that.
Well, I hope so, Andy. And as part of that, I spoke of my grandchildren. I was older when I was in Iraq. I turned 54 when I was there. There's a lot of members of the reserves that were in the same position. But I have 8 grandchildren, and I speak out, you know, for them to make this country a more peaceful, safer country. And, you know, they're too young. Most of them are too young to know what I'm doing, but I keep 3-ring binders, and I hate to tell you this, but I'm on my 4th 3-ring binder keeping track of all the speaking out I've done against these wars. So
yeah.
At some point in time, my grandchildren will read those. And then, you know, I can take some satisfaction in knowing that at least I tried, even if I wasn't successful. And my grandchildren will know that too.
Absolutely.
So keep spreading the news for peace, Andy. Keep speaking out. So the only thing I can tell these people is nothing's going to change until more people, you know, start doing that.
Right. Would you like to read some of the names of the fallen?
You know, do you have access to your computer right there, Andy?
Yeah.
Why don't we kind of take a break on this, and I'll just email you some things quick. I'll email you a link to the Washington Post, and what I want you to do is I want you to look at the state, your home state, and I want you to look at your hometown and see if you can find somebody from there, and I want you to just take a look at that, and I want you to discuss that person online. You know, take this offline for a second.
Okay.
And I'll send it to you, and I want you to look that up, and I want you to look up those names, and just one name, and see, find out more about that person, and I want you to share that with the people.
Okay.
You know, I can talk about people that I know and so forth, but I want this to be personalized to you, Andy, so I'm going to go offline here.
Okay.
I'm going to send you that link. You can find out the state and find out somebody that, you know, somebody from the state that you live from, and we can talk about that when we come back on, so.
We are back from a short break here on Panopticon Podcast Episode 10 with Wes Davey. How are you doing, Wes?
I'm doing good, and you found some information on the internet about somebody from your hometown?
I did. I went to this website you gave me the link to. That's at, I'm finding it on Washington Post, Faces of the Fallen, and you can search by state and city's age to read about those that have fallen in this war. And my hometown is Overland Park, Kansas. And I found a Kevin Ziegler. And I'll just go ahead and read this piece that was in the Kansas City Star after he died in combat. Kevin was born January 5th, 1975 in Springfield, Missouri, and found his calling in life when he enlisted as an Army Scout in 1995. A veteran of numerous deployments, Kevin was welcomed in our Lord's Kingdom on August 12, 2006, as he bravely served with C Troop 1st Squadron, 10th United States Cavalry in Iraq. Kevin was a loving father and husband, and he will be deeply missed and forever loved by his caring wife, Stacy, his children, Collie, Sierra, Tyler, and Dawn. Kevin shared a special relationship with them, one that will never be replaced or forgotten. He was a devoted father and husband who gave all for his wife and children. It was not the way that Staff Sergeant Kevin Ziegler died that made him a hero. It was the way that he lived. A man with strong faith and a true love for life, Kevin approached every day as a new beginning and every challenge as an opportunity. Admired by senior leaders, respected by peers, and loved by subordinates, Kevin was a soldier's soldier at home in the outdoors, naturally gifted with equipment and machinery, and possessed of a special ability to make the seemingly overwhelming simple. While known for his outstanding leadership and engaging personality, Staff Sergeant Ziegler always found time to help those in need. Willing to stand up for what he believed to be right, Kevin never faltered in his desire to live and serve honorably. Perhaps more than any other trait, it was Kevin's sincere compassion for those we were attempting to help in Iraq that made him special. Although constantly fighting incredibly difficult situations, he always treated each individual as one of God's children. Those who have had the honor of being touched by Kevin's life will be forever grateful for the lessons he has taught us all.
So, earlier when we were talking, I spoke about how much I care about the soldiers that I served with. It was people like Kevin Ziegler who make up the bulk of the military, and they are very great people, and they deserve our respect and our honor. And I would hope that reading that and going to that website has made you feel just a little bit differently about this war and has personalized it for you. And
this could be anyone. This could be my best friend. This could be my brother. And I really appreciate that you showed me this website, and I'm going to spend a lot of time on this website and actually make a commitment to read about each person that falls in these wars. Because you're exactly right. It's not personalized for us. We don't have the draft, and these people are unfortunately just kind of thought of as statistics, but they're fathers and husbands, and leaves such a horrendous toll on their home communities and their families.
Kind of makes you want to work towards peace. At least it does me. And it's people like Kevin Ziegler, they're my inspiration to keep working for peace. I feel that I owe it to them. And we keep working for peace and end these wars. I'm not going to give out names, but I want to tell about some friends of mine. Their son served in Iraq pretty close to the beginning of the war, and he served with the Marine Corps. Before he went in the Marine Corps, he was a typical 18-year-old kid. He went to church every Sunday with his family and so forth, and he learned the things that the church teaches, like thou shalt not kill. And after 9/11 and so forth, he joined the Marine Corps, and he was sent to Iraq. And when he was in Iraq, he was part of a convoy. And part of the rules for that convoy and part of the rules of engagement was that the convoy keep moving no matter what, no matter if somebody ran out in front of you or whatever. Well, somebody did run out in front of the convoy. And this young man was part of the vehicles that ran over the young child that ran out in front of the convoy. Needless to say, this would haunt or should haunt any person, especially one that has somewhat of a religious background like this young man did.
Yeah.
So he came home after his tour of duty, and he struggled with post-traumatic stress and the horrors of the wars that he saw. He didn't start using drugs, but he started drinking more and more and more, and he knew he had a problem. And it just broke his parents up. It just tore them apart seeing their son struggle like this, and they tried to get him help at the VA. And at that time, the VA had a requirement that before they give him help for PTSD or whatever, or admit him, that the person had to be sober. Well, this young man was always drunk. He was always trying to use alcohol to cover up what he'd seen, I guess.
Right.
So he did go into treatment a couple of times, but he kept drinking and he kept fighting with the horrors of wars that he saw. He kept struggling with that. So one night his father came home from work and sat on the couch. And, as a father of five children, I can totally relate to this here, this happening. And the son came over and, by that time he was in his early 20s, and he asked the father if he could sit on his lap and just be held for a while. So as a father, this is pretty touching to me. And so he sat on his father's lap for a while, and then later that night, the father went to work, and the next morning he came home, and he found his son's body in the garage. He had committed suicide. He just couldn't handle it anymore.
Jesus.
So these are my friends, and this is something that they have to struggle with the rest of their life, So if you want to make it personal, there's something personal right there. The suicides among returning veterans, it's just as high for the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans as it was for the Vietnam era veterans. And in Vietnam, more people died from suicide after they came home than were actually killed in the war. And I'm sorry to say, Annie, that that trend seems to be happening here with these two wars. It's just here in Minnesota, I've seen too many suicides of those coming home. As an example, one Memorial Day, I took a group of people from the church I go to. I took them out to Fort Snelling National Cemetery. Tried to drive home the real effect of, that the war has. In other words, actually seeing the grave markers there and so forth. And so we went out there and walked among the gravestones and so forth. And then we just stood under a tree and talked for a while. And while we were doing that, a young girl came up and she sat by the grave of a soldier who I knew had committed suicide. And so I went over there and I talked with her and tried to comfort her. I told her who I was, you know, that I was an Iraq veteran, and I knew what had happened to her fiancé. You know, the war not only affected him and eventually killed him, it's now affected his fiancé for the rest of her life. And she'll go on to do something different, but this is something that will affect her the rest of her life.
Yeah.
Another time when I was out of Fort Snelling, this may seem kind of morbid, but I feel going out there kind of inspires me to keep on speaking out.
Yeah.
And just being among those who have died. So one time I was out there and I saw two young women in their early 20s sitting beside somebody who had died in Iraq. And so I went over and talked with them. And one was just a girlfriend to the other, the one girl there, and she, it was her husband's, whose gravestone was there. And they just came out there to be with him, to spend time with him. And they had only been married 2 months when he had died. He went over there and was killed shortly after he had arrived in Iraq. And so she had to be this person's wife for only 2 months before he died. This is what's happening every day throughout our country. You know, if you take the position that the war is immoral and wrong and that we should get out of there, then you have I think it's required of you to speak out against that war and do what you can to stop it. So I think it's wrong. I think it's immoral, both wars. So I keep speaking out. And it's for these young women crying beside the graves of the people they loved. It's for the people sitting over at the VA hospital over in Minneapolis who have traumatic brain injury and might never be able to talk again or visit with their families. And it's for the people that struggle with PTSD throughout our country. I mean, somehow this stuff has to end, in my opinion, and until it does, for their sake, for the sake of my family, for the sake of my grandchildren, for the sake of our country, I'll keep speaking out, Andy. And I would just encourage other people to do the same to the extent that they can.
Absolutely. And thank you for all the work that you are doing towards that end. I have a real quick question I'd like to know, and I think it's really relevant right now at this point in the conversation, is what kind of advice would you give to a guy who just came home from Iraq or Afghanistan who is traumatized in so many of these different psychological, physical, or spiritual ways? What would you say to them?
I'd say don't shut out your friends. Keep in contact with them, especially the military friends. Let's be honest here. Your family's not going to understand what you've gone through, but those who you have served with will understand, and they're the ones that can get you through the rough times. So keep in contact with your friends. And in the Army, they have this thing called the buddy system. You've got a battle buddy, and you're supposed to keep track of them. Well, even after the war ends and when you come home, you should have a battle buddy that you can talk to and keep them squared away, help them when they need help. And I'll give you an example of this. I have a friend in IVW who lives here in the metro area of St. Paul, Minneapolis. He and I did not serve together, but we've become close friends through IVW. And he called me over. He asked me to come over to this place one day. One Saturday afternoon, so I came over there and I brought my dog, and he has a dog. And what had happened is he had been sitting, until he called me, he had been sitting all day on his bed with a loaded 45 sitting next to him. Jesus. Ray ended. So fortunately for him and for me, he reached out to me, and I went over there and we just walked for a long time and talked for a long time. And I can tell you right now that, you know, he still has the scars of wars on him, and he always will have that. But he's doing a heck of a lot better, and he knows how to deal with things. And, you know, to the extent that I could be his battle buddy at that point in time, I'm glad I could do it. So for those coming home, there's going to be some tough times probably, and you need to reach out to people, and don't be afraid to do it. You know,
yeah.
Open up and talk to them and let them help you, and you help them when they need it. So if I have any advice, I guess it would be that right there.
Well, Wesley, it's been a high privilege and a joy to be able to speak with you this evening and talk about these very difficult subjects. And I really have the highest amount of respect for the type of work you're doing and the type of work that Iraq Veterans Against the War is doing and the type of assistance they offer to not only veterans but also to trying to speak out about what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also with veterans back home, and also to try to end these horrendous and horrific conflicts. And so thank you so much for taking the time and speaking with us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate being invited to share some of my thoughts with you, and I really ask that your listeners go to that website, the Washington Post one, and also ask him. I sent you a web link to Kevin Tillman's article. It's a pretty powerful statement about the war and what we're doing as a nation. I'd ask you to put that up on your website too. And you know, if people read this and they look at it, I think they will be touched, and hopefully touched to the point where they will at least write a letter to their representatives in Congress. So,
what can our listeners do to support Iraq Veterans Against the War? What's the best way to do that?
I'll be blunt and honest with you. If they go to the IVW.org website, and if they can make a contribution, even if it's just $5 or $10 or $20, I'm telling you, that money is well spent, and it will go a long way to spread the gospel of peace and anti-war. So to the extent that they can share $5, $10, $20, I'd ask them to go to the IVW.org website and just share that small amount of money. I mean, I'll tell you one thing, we will use it to do what we can to end these wars and to help veterans coming back. So thank you.
Okay, very well. I will post links to all that stuff right at the top of the page. And Panopticon Podcast, thanks Wes Davey from Iraq Veterans Against the War for taking the time to speak with us. And keep on what you're doing, because it's so important.
All right, thank you, Andy. Have a good day.
You too, Wes. All right, take it easy.
Bye.
Bye.